So now let's turn the do's and don'ts of launching a community. I'm going to stick with the positive first, and then we'll get into the don'ts. And some of it may seem commonsensical, but many people need, especially for the don'ts, need to be told this because it's not natural in the Web 2.0 when you're shifting from, you know, owning the site and being the webmaster and always being the authority and being able to delete things off your message board if you want to, and you still can. But, you know, there's a lot of difference there. So being able to give up a little bit of control and not being offended by certain users and certain controversial issues, how to deal with them, we'll talk about in the don't section. But let's talk about the do section of launching a community and the things you should understand, as this is the basic concepts in week one. So in the do's category, I think understanding Robert Cialdini's weapons of influence is extremely important in launching a community, because with the community and with social networking, you are dealing with people. At the end of the day, it's all about influencing people. It's all about making people act. MySpace is able to do it to 200 million. YouTube is able to do it to the tunes of millions. Facebook to the tunes of millions. But to make good money, you don't have to have millions of users. Who knows? You may be the one to create the next super micro niche. I know that sounds oxymoronical or whatever, but maybe you might be the next one to create a big success in your small niche or whatnot. But it all comes back to understanding certain principles and how they work in creating a community. And all of these principles I keep in the forefront when I'm designing certain campaigns or strategies, or trying to get members more active, or trying to get the members that aren't active through the funnel, pushing them through that engagement funnel from a newbie all the way down to a site evangelist, from a stranger to a participant, all these things, and even just attracting new members. So understanding Robert Cialdini's weapons of influence, which he's a professor at Arizona State University and did a lot of research in this area. If you don't have this book, I highly recommend it. I'm on my third time reading it, and every marketer I know has read that book, or that's a no-no. Okay? Now, the six weapons that Cialdini talks about are reciprocity, commitment and consistency, social proof or validation, liking, authority, and scarcity. So briefly, let's talk about each of these weapons of influence and how to use them to get people to join, participate, share, and spend. These are concepts you need to know. And they're also concepts you just need to know in internet marketing and selling in general, and persuasion and copywriting and just life, if you want to know the truth. So on the list, the first one is reciprocity. So why the heck does this matter to you in creating a community? Because people feel the need to reciprocate or give in exchange to someone else when they are given something for free. So just the essence of your community, you don't know how many people in the Zone community thank me and send me private messages just for being the one to have the vision to bring all these people together. They're piano players, they're musicians. They were never given the attention by their local musician or teachers, or maybe someone in their church wouldn't share piano techniques with them, or was, you know, jealous or didn't want, you know, people in the church congregation to take their job. So it was real a secretive thing, you know, the way they play. And this is a really big a problem in my little micro niche. And a lot of people say that. So I'm the one bringing all these people together to share chords and musical concepts and share ideas. And I'm thanked for that. Just the foundation I'm being able to provide for this interaction. Let's just take away all my courses and DVDs and stuff like that. Just the interaction I'm creating and facilitating here. And it's free for my members. It's free for them to join and communicate with each other. And so people feel the need to reciprocate just on that level. And since many of the features of the community are free, when the time comes to buy or for when it comes to have a paid membership portion of the site or courses available, most people feel the need to reciprocate. They feel like they owe you. I mean, many people come, man, we owe you big time for this. And I create diehard fans because there's no strings attached in the community. Of course, I sell lots more courses because of these underlying persuasion techniques, and because just the atmosphere the community creates, you know, so the social proof, we'll talk about that soon, and just having all these people in one place, I mean, pretty much people follow others, and they see all these other people follow me, they feel led, pushed to follow me, and there's so many built-in benefits how you can sell more products by just having people in this place. That's like your proof over there. That's like, hey, if 70,000 people follow me, why are you taking so long to get on the bandwagon? 95% of people are imitators, only 5% are initiators. So and that's in the future, but reciprocity, most people feel the need to reciprocate. Caldini actually remembers sending Christmas cards to perfect strangers and being surprised at how many people actually sent Christmas cards back. You don't even have to know people. If you send them, if you give somebody a gift, they feel like they need to reciprocate with you. Another experiment he ran was where people came to an art appreciation class. It was, you know, put in the paper, I guess. People came to this class, and a particular gentleman, what he did when he left for break, they had a break, he brought back two Cokes, one for him and one for the person sitting next to him. And of course, the guy said thanks and all that kind of stuff. And later on, the guy who brought back the Coke to this subject, he doesn't know he's a subject, Caldini's doing an experiment here. And in the cases where he brought back a Coke, just being generous, the person bought way more raffle tickets, almost double, triple the amount of raffle tickets because of this need to reciprocate. And in cases where, you know, he didn't bring back a Coke, you know, people still bought tickets or whatnot, but not nearly as much as the people who were given a free gift. So just remember that giving first and initiating this reciprocation, it gets it back, and it gets it back more than what you've done. You can just give somebody something that costs a quarter and they'll feel like reciprocating you for something that costs 10 bucks. There's no rationale there, but that's why it's a very big influence, persuasion technique. So that's reciprocation. And like I said, give with no strings attached, no gimmicks. This is not the free DVD that, you know, comes with strings attached. Commitment and consistency is the second weapon of, and I don't like the word weapon. He uses it pretty, you know, he's pretty serious about it. These are just influence techniques. They help you, and then there's some bad guys out there that use them against you for their goodwill. But in commitment and consistency, what this means is that once we make a decision and that decision is validated by public affirmation, we rarely change our opinion. Or else if we do, that makes us look inconsistent. Well, how does this apply to the community? Because in a community, everything is transparent. Everything is out there. Every member has their own profile. They have a blog. So if I'm asking on the profile, you know, what instrument they play and when they want to reach their goals and which courses they bought and which courses they plan on buying, you know, I'm kind of trying to, you know, mix the sales in there with the profile and things like that. And they make this public affirmation that they want to play the piano better, and they want to be the best piano player they can be. You know, this may just seem like a nice creative expression and a profile and, oh, wow, Hear and Play allows the ability for people to have profiles. But what it's really doing is it's encouraging people to make public affirmations. And when people make and stand their ground publicly, we change our opinions and we want to align with those affirmations. And when we don't act in alignment with those, we seem inconsistency, and that's frowned upon. That's not good. It creates internal conflict. So with that known, if you get people to publicly take action, you pretty much have them to do anything you want in turn. When you come back at them and say, hey, well, you're the one told me you want to play piano in 6 months. Well, these are the steps to take. And one of those steps is to really get serious and invest in this particular course and that course, or take this particular action. And so that's how this works. And commitment and consistency is so powerful. And you'll find out in Caldini's book that people at the racetrack, just after they place their bet on a horse, they get extremely more confident about that horse than they were before they placed their bet, because that bet is their commitment. Another thing, salespeople will often ask you questions to get you to reveal, you know, certain things about yourself. And then they go into their clothes. And if you if you kind of change, you seem inconsistent. You seem like a liar. So if somebody gets you to say, oh, yeah, you go out to dinner and you go out to dinner twice a week. Oh, and you go out to amusement parks and you have kids. And oh, you go to the theater and you spend, you know, $1,000 a year on entertainment, or you do this, and they get you to, and you think you're doing it because you're a big shot, or maybe because the person's attractive or cool. And you're like, yeah, I go to the movies. Oh, yeah, three times a week. And I do this, and I got this fancy car. And then they come back and say, well, we're selling an entertainment card, and you could save $500, you know, on all the things you say you already do. Didn't you say you do those, Mr. Griggs? You just buy our car for $200, and you can save $500, $700, $800. And based on what you told me, you probably can save $1,000 because you go out once a week, right? See how they get you to get that commitment and consistency against you. And so in the same way, it works in a community. If you get all these people together and now they're, you know, they create buddy buddies. Another thing they do is that buddies, you know, certain leaders emerge within the community and get people to commit to certain things. Hey, guys, let's commit to improving our piano in 6 months. And all of us will post our file in the media center and see how we've improved. So that makes other members, if they've already committed to doing this, want to step up their game. How do they step up their game? Well, they're at this site called hearandplay.com, and we do have a course. We have multiple courses to help them. So commitment and consistency not only works for you to get members to commit, stay consistent with their commitments, rather, but it also works peer to peer in the interactions between one another. So depending on your niche, this could be a gold mine for you, especially if you follow up and you mention those commitments in the follow up. Social proof and validation is probably the biggest influence persuasion technique prevalent among communities, Web 2.0 applications, and social networks. Because basically what social proof or social validation says is that we decide what is correct by noticing what other people are doing around us. So you understanding this is a major do. Okay, social proof. Basically, you want to use the leverage of your members. Now, this is hard to do in the beginning, but once you get 10,000 members, hey, 10,000 people are doing it. Hey, 20,000 people are doing it. 70,000 people are doing it. And so with social proof, when people first join, or maybe when they get their first exposure to you, generally takes 7 exposures for somebody to consider your offer. Some experts say more. But when people get that first exposure, you know, when you have a web 1.0 site or just a sales page, yeah, it's a one-way interaction. But when they can get on and see all these people hanging out and all these people collaborating and commingling and all the just this really enhanced communication between people of like minds and all around the world, think of the social proof, how it really speeds up the process of them liking, knowing, and trusting you, because they're like, hey, we're all looking for shortcuts. We don't want to do the research. I don't want to make sure that Jermaine Griggs guy is all right. You know, 70,000 other people are kind of validating that he's all right. And that's how it works. So the way you position photos on your site, the way you position new members, the way you position how many people have joined, people from this particular geographic location, how many beginners versus advanced you have, showing people that, hey, you're not the only one. There's lots of people here just like you, the same goals, the same missions. If they done it, you can too. You're in the beginning now, but look at all these other people here, members over here doing this. There's members from Mississippi over here just like you. You know, there's many ways to personalize your community and to personalize your sales message. And really now you got other people to help you sell for you. If basically your goal is to sell more products through having a community and connecting people together and them getting the leads for you, just think about the social proof. Now, it gets even better in ambiguous situations when people don't know what to do in a certain situation, or you're at a restaurant. You don't know whether it's not an upscale one, but it's not a fast food. You don't know whether to get rid of your plate or whether the guy comes and cleans off the table. So you look around and you're pretty much usually you can get some clues from around you. If the next guy leaves his plate, okay, I'm supposed to leave my plate and just leave. Next guy puts it in a trash can, okay, I guess this is a place where you go dump your food in a trash can. So, and people do that when they join communities as well. So you want to make it easy. You want to put members out there. You want to advertise feature members, ideal members, so people can see the actions and the way to be. If everyone else is doing it, it must be correct. And obviously, in just basic sales sites, testimonials, product endorsements, feature members. All of those are social proof helpers. And like I said, 95% of people are imitators, 5% are initiators. People, they really get us in television. Laugh tracks. Laugh tracks are, I mean, they're pretty much social proof at its best because, and many of us, we get used to it. I mean, I think executives can do a lot better with their laugh tracks, especially the ones that laugh too loud and the joke's not even funny. But basically, when we hear an audience laughing on a sitcom, we think whatever happened is that much funnier. You know, the audience didn't laugh, we wouldn't think it's funny. And you ever been somewhere and you laughed out loud and everybody else didn't and you felt stupid, but you really thought it was funny, but you felt stupid? Why feel stupid when you thought it was funny? It's not your fault. 99% of the crowd didn't think it was funny, but that's how powerful social proof is. Also, kids, if a kid was scared of a dog, they talk about this in Caldini's book. If you just show a video, you don't have to show a real kid playing with a dog, but if you show a video to somebody, of a kid, another kid, the same age, looks like the kid, you know, general similarities, and show a video to this kid who's scared of dogs and let them watch it for about 20 minutes of a kid their own size playing with a dog. After that video, that kid will be more apt to play with dogs, and that fear will leave because of social proof, because of seeing other people do things in ambiguous situations where you really don't know what to do or scared, things like that. So that really helps. And in the beginning, it's, social proof is a little difficult because you only have a few hundred members maybe. And maybe a few hundred is all you need in your small niche. Maybe that's impressive. But as you build it up, you really want to take advantage of social proof. And there's many techniques. We'll talk about how you place photos, even in your sales pages, links, and things like that. And once you've reached a few thousand members, like I said, then social proof really kicks in, because now new members can see a measurable amount of people interacting, and they can kind of join in. And you need to be the one in the beginning to really get that social proof going and getting people to interact. The next weapon of influence is liking. And how does this apply to the community model? Because we often say yes to people we know and like. And that's a big, big fundamental. Customers have to know, like, and trust you, right? Customers have to know, like, and trust you. And especially in building communities, it allows one to build that personal relationship, and it makes that person very transparent to their users. Before I started a community, there was really no way to contact me unless you had a very good story or something and you sent it through our normal help desk and it was transferred or escalated up to me. That was probably the best way. And then to be honest, I probably didn't reply to all of them personally. I would have the customer service, you know, do a canned response. You know, Mr. Griggs is thrilled that you've contacted him and stuff like that. But as soon as the community started, there I was out in the open. You can go to my profile. You can see my wedding photos. You can see my daughter. You can see when she was born. We got videos of her birth. I mean, it puts me out there. I'm transparent now. I'm a real guy, and you can click that send a private message, and you can talk to me. And I was very touched when I saw a user's private message to another user. You know, we were looking at, I created a test account, and it's a long story, but pretty much created a test account and said, I'm new to the site. And I sent it out to all my members just because I wanted to see what their reply would be. How do you guys like this site? I'm new to this site. I mean, are you guys active? Just asked a few questions, act like a new member. And I want to see the replies. And out of about 400 replies that same day, I mean, 99.9999, all of them pretty much were positive. I love this site. This site is so great, letting people connect, and the information here and just the attitude, the spirit here. But one particular guy said, you can actually contact the founder. You can contact the owner. And I thought that's just great. And that really touched me, because I'm like, that's what it's all about. And you might not want to be that accessible to folks. You may not want to be the personality or the celebrity, but people feel like they can like you, and they really know you, and you're just down to earth. They feel like they know you. Your community allows you to have this kind of openness, especially if you're on your community as a regular user and you're sending messages and you're, you know, posting, you know, comments and welcoming people in the beginning. That really, really helps. Constant communication produces stronger comfort levels, stronger familiarity, and it produces history. So, and it takes that to get those first evangelists through, especially if you are a personality, especially if they consider you a celebrity. Get on there, become normal, and watch the response you get, and watch how many people get your back and start helping you to build this community as though it's their own. Take on the sense of ownership that you have. And along those lines of liking, think about the Tupperware model. I mean, Tupperware parties. I mean, not only do they have the liking factor in it, but they got reciprocation because they generally play games in the beginning of a Tupperware party. And then if you don't win a prize, you can still pick out of the prize bag and whatnot. So you feel like you got your free gift. That's reciprocation. Then they have social proof because all the other women are buying Tupperware and stuff like that. Then they have the commitment and consistency in Tupperware parties because they make each participant describe certain uses and benefits of Tupperware. I use Tupperware because of this. I use Tupperware. I love Tupperware, and everybody feels the need to say it. That's also social proof as well. I mean, you're not going to be the oddball generally, and you're not going to be at the party if you hate Tupperware. So now when it comes time to buy, well, you've just said all these great uses for, why not more? Why not use the latest and the greatest Tupperware? Now you've already committed publicly. You've affirmed that you love it. They really get you. All of these sit second backseat pretty much to the liking principle, the friendship principle, because the woman or the man hosting the Tupperware party is sitting off in the corner and smiling and grinning and open up his or her house, primarily probably her house, and cook dinner and hors d'oeuvres and things like that. So, and you guys all know she's getting a cut out of the profit. So you feel like, because you like her and you know her and this is your friendship and you want her to do it to you too, that you just have to buy something. You can't leave empty handed. Like, bye, girlfriend. Thank you for the cake. You know, that doesn't sound right. I mean, think about it. When I go to a grocery store, convenience store, I don't know if it's just me, but I feel bad when I leave with nothing. I feel like the teller's looking at me like cheapskate I just feel bad when I leave empty handed. Sometimes I just buy some gum. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I got issues. Pray for me. But I feel bad when I leave a store without buying something, or I went there to buy something, but I guess if I can't find what I'm looking for, I don't know why I feel bad, but that's one of those influences. So if I feel bad leaving a public store in which whom I have no connection with, imagine the liking principle, being able to turn down somebody that you like. So in your community, when you build this trust, this rapport, being able to get people to respond, this relationship, many won't say no to you. And when you combine that with the next principle, which is authority, I mean, you're really on top of the world, getting people to act and moving them along that engagement funnel from a newbie to a site evangelist. Sometimes all you got to do is ask, hey, guys, you enjoying the site? Pass it on and make it easy, which we'll talk about later. So that's the liking factor. Authority. People obey authority figures. This is the fifth principle in Caldini's book. People, they obey authorities. They're trained to. Because they think authorities know more than they do about certain things. And if you are the face of the community, you are automatically looked up to. You're automatically the authority. You are the celebrity. Anything you say goes. You may not know what you're talking about, but you're the one that started this site. Actually, there's a few sites, and I got some buddies out there that have started communities in the actual music realm that don't play the instrument, but people are asking them advice on their profile and how do I do this and how do I do that, because they assume just because this person created the community that they are the expert, they are the authority. It's automatic. It's just how human nature works. If the person's out there in the front and they're the one out there, they're the number one member, they start this thing, they found automatically the authority is inherent there, and we're trained to respect authority, like I said. So when you take the fact that X number of users have joined your community, that even boosts your authority. When you can say you got 70,000 followers, or like me, when you can say you got 230,000 on your mailing list, look what that does to your authority. So, and you use that in conjunction with social proof. Authority is so powerful in Caldini's book that they had an experiment, and they put an ad in the paper, certain amount of money to come do an experiment, and pretty much Caldini was the experimenter, and he had an assistant who was also in on the experiment, and then the person that answered the ad, who has no idea, and he's supposed to basically sit behind a shock machine, which is not really a shocker, but it, but the actor on the other end, the assistant, every time he gets the wrong answer, it's a memory test. So he's supposed to be able to, you know, answer questions based on his memory, you know, gives him some things to look at a few minutes later, ask some questions, and if he gets them wrong, the guy who knows no idea, the subject in this case, presses a shock. And he presses a button and it gives a shock, a jolt, I guess, to the person on the other side. And every time the person gets it wrong, the shock goes up in intensity all the way to like where it can be life threatening. You'd be surprised that every time the person got it wrong, most people would actually give the shocks. They would press the button, even where the person says, oh, this hurts. And the person's, you know, almost having a heart attack. Like the actor's really acting really good. Like, oh, my gosh, don't press it. Don't, like, crying. You know, they're strapped to this chair. And you know what the reason was from that these subjects would continue to press the button? Simply because the experimenter in the white coat told them to. Not because of logic or emotion or, wow, this person is hurt. Very few. We can count the percent on one hand got up and walked away. Most looked at the experimenter and said, I mean, this guy's hurting. Should I keep going, you know, and pressed the button and kept going to the point where even on the machine, it said danger to a certain level. And that's because of authority. And of course, the story is deeper than that. You got to read the book if you haven't. But that people are trained to obey authority. So once you build up this this authority figure, there's a lot that you can do with it to grow your site. Simply asking. You can get moderators this way. Simply asking people to be your moderator. They'll be thrilled. You mean the celebrity is asking me to be a part? You know, their sense of ownership just doubles. Their stock interest in your community triples exponentially when you ask them to come on board as the celebrity and the authority figure. So if you're going to build that up, there's a lot that comes with it. And lastly, scarcity and how you can use that in your community is a big do, because people frequently assign a higher value to scarce items, and companies that offer membership products on a limited time basis know that scarcity commands a higher price. And here's just some ideas to throw off you. The first X members become platinum for free. They're platinum members for free. And we're running out. We're close to our threshold. You know, once community reaches X number of members, this special rank privilege will no longer be available or offer service only for free for a little while or during a beta period. You see that a lot in 2.0. And then it'll cost money to join later. But if they join now, they're grandfathered in. So it'll be free for them, you know, at least at this level. Of course, that doesn't stop you from doing platinum levels later and trying to funnel people into that area to monetize things. But scarcity, you can really, really use it. And we'll talk more about scarcity. But I mean, just take people in baseball collections and stuff like that. It's all because of scarcity. You know, if you got that baseball card nobody else has, or you got the Babe Ruth rookie card or whatnot, I'm not a collector, but scarcity, the scarcity principle is evident in there. In the book, a guy pays $400 for a $1 bill. Okay. What logic is that? $400 for a $1 bill. He paid $400 for something that's only worth a dollar. But no, that $1 bill was one of very few that had no serial numbers or government seals on it. So the guy was right in thinking that it would be worth a lot more than $400 because it was rare. It was scarce, you know? So just think of that. Xboxes and PlayStation 3s, you know, they only come out with limited quantity, and you got people sleeping, you know, in front of stores for 7 days, iPhones and things like that, because of scarcity. So if you can be able to incorporate this into your community somehow, certain amount of members get this, or, you know, contest, you know, when we reach certain amount of members, this will stop or this will happen, or give them reasons and incentives and use scarcity to push. Because people are more likely to do something to avoid pain than to do something to gain pleasure. They'll do something to avoid missing out on something than to do something to gain something else. So use that to your advantage. So those are the do's. And that's deeper than communities, but the community model and the people that are top of their game in the community use this. Okay, I didn't make this up. These are principles that marketers use. They should, at least just in all their business practices as it relates to persuasion. But now here are the don'ts. Okay, so you know some of the concepts you should take on in terms of how you design your community and everything you do in your community. Think of some of these principles. How does this help? Which one of the six are these? And of course, the six doesn't encompass everything, but think about these things and it'll really help you to design your contest properly. How you present photos and new members and how you engage them and how you get them started right away and what really makes people act. So the don'ts, here's the big one. Don't build it and expect everyone to come. That's a big myth. Build it and everyone will come, right? There's an extremely powerful viral effect once you've built up a good couple thousand active users. I really believe that. Once you get enough users in there and you get them trained and you get them further along in that engagement funnel and they really pass it on and they love your site and they live there and they're there daily and they're logging in. Once you get that core group, they'll help you to grow the site. They'll help you to get people, you know, strangers, which are people further, you know, toward the beginning of the engagement funnel. They'll help you to get those. And then of course your process will make those strangers eventually site evangelists, hopefully. But in the beginning, you can't just expect all these people to come. You really got to do like grassroots marketing. They don't come on their own. You really got to, you know, work it, go other places where they are. If you don't have a lot of money and attract them, tell them, you know, benefits of your community, write articles, put them in articles, databases and things like that. I'll talk about this in a few specific things you can do, but these are things that mindsets you shouldn't have. Number two. Don't expect everyone to be active on their own. Don't think just because you got all these components, your main talked about groups, they're just supposed to automatically know how to create and want to create a group and see the what's in it for me in creating a group. That just doesn't work. There's an educational aspect required in the beginning. And pretty much there's never an end to the beginning. Because there's always a new member coming on. Okay, yes, social proof kicks in and they can see 70,000 people doing stuff. That initial group, the education is more vital than maybe when somebody can easily come on and see, you know, 699,000 people interacting on their own and kind of get in where they fit in. But like I said, there is an educational aspect. And sometimes it takes doing Camtasia videos, and I'll talk really how to do this. Snagit, screenshots, and really show them how to do certain things. Basecamp HQ does this very well with their project management. They actually show pictures of you clicking on new message. This is how you start a new message. We notice you haven't sent the message yet. Here's how to do it. We notice you haven't updated your profile yet. Here's how to do it. We notice you haven't really commented on other people's pages. Here's how to do it. You know, here's how to post a new form. Here's how to hook up, pimp out your profile page. Here's how to do our free lessons, you know, things like that. So they must be educated. Don't assume they know what to do. Show them how to do it. Little pop-ups, Camtasia, you know, like I said, you snag it, various areas of the site. Okay, I just created a test in Basecamp. They're a great project management site, but I created a group and I'm actually calling the group community. Oh, I spelled that wrong. It's supposed to be Community Masters. And notice, welcome. Get started by clicking a tab above. Learn about the overview. Watch a video demo below. You can watch this video or view a screenshot anytime from the overview tour page. See, click me to start. And I think this is very powerful when somebody's new to your service or doesn't know what to do. Even when I click on new message, or not new message, but when I go to the messages tab. Post the first message for this project. Learn about messages. Watch a video demo below. So virtually any section I go to, if I haven't done anything, this is easy to program, right? A programmer can tell if somebody's done something or not. It has a video offering me advice or direction in what to do. Milestones. Haven't done that? There's a video. Their whiteboard features, video, chat. Well, they don't do it there. That's pretty self-explanatory. But and then the time module. So Basecamp is a Web 2.0 company. They're really good at making applications online and things like that. And I just thought that was interesting for you guys to see. So you do that same thing in your community to get people active. There's an educational process. Expecting everyone to be active on their own. Okay, that's a key thing as well. and we'll continue a little bit. Be active yourself. Hire someone to keep things moving in the beginning. Like I said, in the beginning, I actually hired a moderator. It was like $100, $200 a month, and he would be on there helping me answer questions, posing new topics, and just keeping things fresh because things can get dead. Hot forum discussions, even controversial ones, believe it or not. And we'll talk about how that works in the community model a little bit later. But sometimes you want controversial topics because that gets people logged in, because people rather be in tune to the dirt than empowerment. It's just sad, but that's how people are. Encourage user interaction. Encourage user ownership. Get them to commitment by creating profiles, posting blog notes, or creating groups. And we'll talk about the funnel later, but the minute you get somebody to take an action, a public action, they feel better about your community that second after. It's just like the person that go bets on a horse. I don't bet on horses, but I understand how this works through Caldini, and just I know people, family members, in fact, that bet on horses. As soon as they put the money down, now they're pumped. Oh, my horse is going to win, you know. You automatically get pumped. You start dating a new person, all of a sudden you like them after that first kiss, that first commitment. You just like them anyway, even more, right? You don't know why. Nothing really has changed. As soon as you commit to something, you stay consistent. You want to. That's human nature. So get them to commit to creating a profile. And now their profile, they have sense of ownership now. They have interest in your community. Their profile, they feel like they have real estate in your world. Posting blog notes, same thing. Oh, when they create a group, oh, you got them now, because now they have their own thing. You mean I can come to Hear and Play and create my own group? I can have my own piano group of people that play piano from San Diego. You mean I can have my students? You know, piano teachers, I got my students come onto your site and I can keep up with them all in this one place, and they can have access to other piano players from around the world, and I can manage that, and I can delete their posts, and I can invite them, and I can manage this whole thing. You mean to tell me I can do that all at Hear and Play? See, so that sense of ownership, you get the point. Promote some type of contest or point reward system that also gets people to get active. So just don't expect them to be active because you built it. First of all, you know, the myth, build it and they will come. And then the second myth, build it and they will be active. And then the third myth, build it and they will buy. No, there's persuasion in all of this. So controlling it to death is one of the big no-nos. Really, Web 2.0 is all about user control. And that's what people have to realize, especially us marketers. User control. And the thing is, if you don't have good service, you don't have a good product, and this bites you in the butt, right? Because now you got a bunch of people together that hate you, and you know if you're hating, you're probably not going to be in business a long time. People like that, right? So Web 2.0 does you no good when users have control and they don't like you. But if they like you, it does that much better for you, because now it's like, wow, isn't Jermaine great? Or isn't that person great? Isn't the owner of this site great? I mean, his courses are great, and he connects us together for free. We can learn from each other. So they have control. Now, when a user does get out of hand, and like I said, participation is a sense of ownership. Users embrace what they create, like the American Idol. But there is balance. You want to balance it, but you also want users to know that they are free. Because if you're deleting everything they post, the users are going to get the point, and they're not going to want to be involved with something. They can't have liberty to post what they want. You know, okay, we had to balance this too with our gospel products. I mean, do we create a blues form, a jazz form? We went ahead and did it, and we haven't had any backlash from our gospel market. Plus, our blues people are on there, and they're all commingling. Music is music. At the end of the day, it's really the intent of the music. I mean, the blues sound is in the gospel sound and all this stuff. So, you know, we've learned that as well, you know, letting the users choose what they want. They'll tell you they don't like it. And generally the consensus will be collective, you know, so balance that order, but allow users to be free. Rule of thumb is like the utilitarian approach when it comes to death penalty and stuff. I was a law major. Rule of thumb, greater good for the greatest number of people. That's a good rule of thumb. Okay. If it's just a little bit of controversy, it's not going to hurt one person. Right? It may offend a few people, but it'll get people logged in and participating. And if they have to cut down a bad guy in the community, they'll do that collectively, and it'll create a stronger bond. Create an environment where people feel comfortable participating. That's another thing. Like I said, controversy draws. Don't be afraid to let some things just kind of fly. Don't even be afraid to let some people talk about you. Maybe there'll be a few bad rotten apples, but you know what? commonly happens is that users come to the rescue, as I'll talk about soon. And it's like Superman cape, like, Jermaine sucks. And then you got like 50 members coming saying, you know, we rebuke you, get out of here, you know, stuff like that. And it makes the community stronger. Making it too complicated. I'm guilty of this sometimes, I'll admit. Too many features too fast, too many options for them versus time releasing it. So in the beginning, sometimes you don't want to roll out everything on your dream list. You don't want to have to wear out a programmer until he's done and then you launch. Just launch. Just get started. Microsoft and a lot of these people out there, their mantra is like, release it and then fix it, or release it and then make it better. I mean, Web 2.0 is no better. That's why everything says beta, because if people wait around trying to make their community perfect, and they wouldn't release. So just release it and don't make it too complicated. Make it simple. One of the big things about Web 2.0, like I said, I'm guilty of this a lot sometimes, is one of the things is simplicity. OK, so just a few options, but a few powerful options. And then from those options, other options, and not too many features. Just really, because you'll find probably Pareto principle. 80% of users are just doing 20% of what your site really offers, because maybe the other 80% really doesn't appeal to them as much as you would think it does. So, and time release just means, you know, just release certain things every, you know, month or so, you know, hey, here's a new feature. And plus, it feels like you have their best interest. It feels like the site is growing. So in their sense of ownership, they feel ownership and pride that, wow, the site is getting better. I can't wait to see what it looks like next year. And we're really growing. They're using the words we're. The family is growing, you know, and that's what it's all about. Too many choices, too many options. That's a no-no. Taking things personally. Don't take things personally. Users will talk. Don't feel offended by every little thing they say. Like I said, because if you're an authority, your likability, because of your rapport, those committed members, those site evangelists. I have two members particularly that I can remember off the top of my head, Lady D and Tammy ID, among many that are like this. They are hardcore members. You say anything about me, you say anything about the site, and they are going to come to the rescue. They're going to defend, and then other members are going to come in, and that controversy kind of helps. And, you know, get in under one of your guest accounts and kind of post and say, what do you guys think about this? Send out a group message to your friends. That sends more people there. And just the dynamic that's created is very, very interesting. When you get, you have a lot of people logged in, you know, you have your advertisements. I find when there's controversy going on, or maybe, you know, we had a religious controversial era of our site at one point where certain members were kind of bringing others into it, but it created a dynamic, and there's balance there. Don't get it to where your community divides, but it ended in love, ended in everybody, you know, really understanding each other, and it made the community closer. That is the do's and don'ts, all the way from influence and persuasion tactics, the do's in launching, what you need there, some of the concepts and strategies, whether members know it or not, they need to be prevalent, and then the don'ts, which really come from your attitude, what not to expect, what not to do. Okay, now we're going to move on to technical aspects of running a community. Okay, so technical aspects of running a community. I'm not going to spend too much time, but the things that I will cover, I think, are very important. A lot of people wonder, so when you start a community, is it hard, or is there just a lot of things to do? It seems pretty overwhelming, but it really isn't. I can tell you on one page the things that I had to do in the beginning, and some of these things I don't even do. I just have staff do them. You know, generally content approval, but you can really outsource that to your hardcore members at some point. Forum moderatorship. Like I said, in the beginning, I hired somebody, but you can do it on your own in the beginning if you have expertise in the topic or the field, or you're passionate about it anyway. Or as you get more of your site evangelists and hardcore members, they're going to want to do it for you. And because of your authority and your likability, they're going to do it, and they're going to do it for free. Spam removal, generally that is the same thing as forum management. You know, when you got bad people like spammers joining and stuff, you know, you have to remove that sometimes. That can, that's one of those things you don't let fly, because that can affect the integrity of your community, and it shows that you're not staying on top of it. So if you go to a forum and have like 10 spam posts, and you know, it just seems like it's not being taken care of. So why should they care? Why should they have a sense of ownership if the owner doesn't even keep up with, you know, their own site? Common tasks, user engagement and participation, which is the theme of what we're talking about pretty much. In the beginning, you're going to have to be that one probably. So that's a common task. But that's fun. That's roaming around in your own community. That's, you know, sitting back and with a soda pop or something and just enjoying your own community and really interacting with people. Do you love this? Is this your passion? Now, if it's not your passion, this will be a grueling process or whatnot. But if you really like this and these are your customers, this will do you well. This will increase your sales just by being accessible to people and just being around and engaging and commenting and happy birthday and welcoming people. If not you, somebody doing it under your name or your user account. User modification, customer support. These are common people, you know, they forget their passwords and stuff. So that's something. There is a forget password feature in my community, and yours will have that probably. But there's just some people that can't figure that part out, and that's minimal. But I just, you know, customer support, you do have to handle that just like anything. And then briefly, I want to talk about servers. Dedicated hosting is preferred for a community because there's so many components going around. There's so many things happening that shared hosting just pushes the envelope. And there's something called availability and reliability. Now, I'm not a techie. I don't claim to be, but one of my programmers did put me up on game, as the young people would say, with this. And it really has to do with how serious you are about being up. You know, how many days out of the year your site is actually up and running and not down or slow or whatnot. And there's this thing called the 3-9s. And generally, most hosting companies, dedicated hosting, share company, if you go to their availability section or like what they say about their availability, they'll post a number like 99.9% available or, you know, whatever, or 99.9999%, you know. So the difference of 3-9s and the difference of 6-9s. So you generally call it that as well. You may think, oh, this is just so picky. I mean, why does it matter, right? But I thought that too, especially for my sales website too. You get what you pay for. You get a cheap host. And they're like, we're only 90% up. Let me show you what that means. So if somebody says they got uptime availability of 90%, that means if they're up 90% of the year, that means they're down 10% of the year or can be without any legal obligation, because they tell you up front, we can be down 10%. Don't expect for us to be, you know, they tell you. So you don't have any case against them. That means they're down 36.5 days a year. If you make $1,000 a day and you're down 36 on average, okay, I doubt that a site will be down straight 2 days or you got a problem bigger than this. But just an hour here, 10 minutes there, 2 minutes there, you know, you go to your site, it's not accessible, something happens. I've been there, done that, baby, 2004, right? You know, and it adds up to 36.5. And they say, well, we're 90% uptime. I mean, that's $36,000 if you make $1,000 a day. If you make $2,000 a day, that's like $70,000. If you make $3,000 a day, that's $100,000. Just because you only want to pay $40 a month rather than $100 a month, or $100 a month rather than $300 a month. 95% uptime, that means you're down 18 days a year. 99%, we're getting better, you're only down 3 days a year. 99.9, that's the 3-9s. You're down only eight hours a year, which is great. 99.99, 4-9s, you're down 52 minutes a year. And what I have, I'm here. 5-9s, you're only down 5 minutes. And practically, if you got 6-9s, which is 99.9999%, you're only down 31 seconds. So practically what they're telling you is that you're never down. We have 100%, and if we're ever down, we'll refund you those fees for the month and whatnot. Just to give you some ideas, and so, and because I use, well, I actually use two hosts. My main host that hosts my community and my main sales website is Rackspace, and they're always up. And they're 24/7. They call me in the middle of the night. They have full staff there. You never feel like they're on vacation or one man band. And then I have others, my sub sites and blogs and things that, you know, might not be, you know, crucial. They're 99.9. So they get 3-9s, which is not even 8 hours a year down. And that suffices too. just to give you some ideas, Rackspace, who I use, 99.99, HostGator, I use them as well, 99.9. I have some GoDaddy stuff as well, 99.9. Haven't used PowWow, but they're 99.9. And so think about how much you make. Think about how many members you sign up a day. Think about your mailing list. Think about all these factors. And when you look for a host or just in your own business, go look for that uptime. And if you're down, you may be thinking you're saving money, but you're really, it's really costing you probably 10 or 100 times more if you're always down. So that's something to keep in mind. And we used to be always down when we first got started until we changed host and really started really trying to make things stable. And as servers grow, as your site grows, so you want to make sure you can add on servers and you can scale up. And like I said, with shared service, not really recommended unless budget does not allow for dedicated servers in the beginning. But at some point, you're going to have to move up. You're going to have to upgrade. And hopefully you're making enough money in advertising or product sales, you know, to take that step, because you're going to be pushing the envelope. Now, with hosted apps, you don't have to worry about scalability, which pretty much means what happens next. What happens when we're so slow because we got, you know, 50,000 members on one server, 100,000 members on one server, and it starts slowing down, you know, scalability, you can add servers and things. They handle all of that for you. You don't have to worry. They have all the technology and technical stuff in place. And those are your sites like OneSite and Ning towards the beginning, whereas the sites that let you white label means to be able to take it on as your own. You know, nobody ever knows you're using this back-end system, because on top it looks like your normal site. But some of those are hosted on your own site. Some of those are hosted on the particular provider site. So it just depends how much you want to take on. And next, we're going to move on to user engagement.